Hey, ladies and gentlemen, tonight's going to be a good night, man. I want to thank all of you, all of my friends, for coming down here. It is a wonderful time. This is something special. This is just the beginning of some more wonderment. This is my very good friend, Nick Nolte. I would like you to show him. Many years ago, we were in a movie together, and it was a movie was called Warrior. And the next thing you know, we became good buddies. My job was to watch Nick Nolte. I said, "What?" They said, "We will pay you some money. You watch Nick Nolte." I said, "There's not enough money in the world. I can't watch Nick." So we became good buddies. And next thing you know, this is 9 years later. I go out to California. He sees me. He called me the other day. And he said, I'll come see you to me in Pittsburgh. I said, "That's nice. Come on down." So now we're here. And I've been running him raggedly. I'm selling all his autographs. I'm selling everything. I'm making a lot of money on this.
The deal is that Jimmy was...
Got to turn on.
I got it on.
Yeah, here, use this one.
All right, yours is louder than mine. You talk louder. Jimmy was supposed to look after me because when in rehearsals, I ended up in a party I shouldn't be. And so I said to the writer early in the morning, I said, "Boy, I haven't been to sleep yet, but I can rehearse. It's going to be fine." And I had talked to Gavin, and Gavin had said, "How are you going to approach this coach of two sons?" And I said, "Well, I don't know yet. I'm still figuring that out. I know I can't hang out with my sons because they're going to want to go to bars and things like that." So Gavin said to me, after he heard I'd been up all night, he said, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" I said, "Well, we need more discipline." And he said, "Discipline? Who are you going to get?" And I said, "Well, give me that guy you call Jimmy from Pittsburgh." Now, only Hollywood calls him Jimmy from Pittsburgh. He's not known as Jimmy from Pittsburgh here. He's Jimmy Civetti. So we gave him that handle. And the best thing that happened was that not only did the father come from him, the trainer comes from him, the walk comes from him, and the whole thing gears around him. And I needed to get as close as I could to him. He didn't know I was on undercover, you know. And so being an undercover narcotics cop didn't scare me at all. But I realized, this is way after the film was over, that I realized that I got most of that character from Jimmy. And certainly the heart of the dad is a Pittsburgh heart. And I got that from Jimmy.
And I'm my friend, eh? So he walks like this now. We was going down the street, I swear to you, yesterday. Oh, no, you can't leave yet.
I have to.
Oh, this is the chief of police from the city. Get a picture. Hey, the chief is here. Thank you. If anybody gets parking tickets or tickets, we will make sure it is right. Thank you, Chief. Man, I love you, bud.
If you have a megaphone and you want to yell in my face, feel free.
See you later, Chief.
I'll see you later.
Hey, much respect, my love. So we were standing there, and we walked past Mitchell's bar, and he's walking just like me, and I'm walking just like him, and this lady stopped, and she said, "Are you two brothers?" I said, "Yeah, we're brothers." But in the history of Nick Nolte, some interesting things have occurred. When we were together, what happened was many things happened. And one of the things that happened, we were over Heinz Field. And together, these people come to us, and we were working on the peace project, Silence the Violence. Nick was working with me, so we go over there, and this lady handed us 2 big bags of rosary beads. So we said, oh, yeah, we'll give them out to everybody. So we're over there, and we would give them out, and we gave everybody rosary beads. But on the way over there, this was what happened. I was down in the dumps that day, because that day, which was April 4th, 2009, 3 police officers were killed in Pittsburgh. And I told Nick, Nick said to me, what did he say?
Well, that was the first day Jimmy was supposed to take care of me. And so I thought he'd arrive, and when I got in the car, he was dead silent, and there was a different Jimmy. That, and I just said, what's wrong? And he said, 3 are down now. We don't know how many more. And he said, now we're still going to go to the Steelers Stadium. Probably it'll be the governor talking and maybe the cardinal. And I'm going to talk for 20 minutes, 5 minutes, and you're still going to talk for 20 minutes. And then we're going to go to all the precincts, and we're going to do whatever we can to help. And that's what we did.
So that is what Nick Nolte did. We went over to the number 1 police station, and all these kids were there. Nick spent about 3 hours there. He didn't do it for any reason than it was the right thing to do. He went over there and helped all these kids. I will never forget that. That was a remarkable day. People were crying, and obviously crying. I was visibly shaken. We're saying, how did this happen?
It was a scary day for law enforcement. In fact, at the hotel I was staying in, the LAPD came in, New York City came in. They came from all over the country.
So that is part of our history. And then every year after that, we get together and we have fun together. Now, I want to let you in on another secret. I did not want to be in this movie. They come to me, they said, Jimmy, you're in the movie. I said, I don't want to be in your movie. And he said, well, you're in the movie. He said, I wrote you, Gavin O'Connor's my friend. He said, I wrote you in the movie. I said, good, write me out of your movie. And he said, everybody wants to be in the movie. I said, not me. And so he said, go see Nick, I'm not writing you out. Nick says, go, sign, it's very easy, I'll help you. They gave me one little line, and I was sitting there, and I met all these crazy women. I met all kind of fun people, and I said, I could be an actor now. And then what is crazier, I come up here. I'm going to let you in on this part of the secret. That movie, Nick Nolte, was nominated for the Best Supporting Actor. And the only reason he got that is because they asked me if I wanted it, and I said, no, give it to Nick.
Yeah, and that meant that I had to put on a tux and go listen to all that Hollywood stuff. But the thing about Jimmy was that I said, well, we got to talking, and I said, what do you do? And he said, well, you know, I was undercover and all this stuff. I said, but what do you do? And he said, well, come on over. And he showed me this pile of papers about 3 feet high. And I said, what's that? And he said, poetry. So I started reading his poetry, and we were talking Brickhousey, we're talking this and this. And I fell in love with his poetry. So I had an assistant named, oh Christ, I'm going to forget his name now. My Alzheimer's is bad.
Mike.
Yeah, Mike and I went to the Venice Poets Society, and we gave him some of the poetry, and they brought Jimmy out, and they wouldn't let Jimmy off the stage. They just hadn't heard that for years, and so.
Yeah. And you know what? It was wonderful. I'm down at Venice Beach. It'd be on broke. It's like the Madison Square Garden reading poet. All it cost me was $5. I gave the man $5. They say, you come stay. But we did have a good day.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I would like to do something here that is notable. Anybody that's a police officer or has been a police officer, please come to the front here. Anybody that's a police officer, sheriff, I saw you hiding back here. You come up here. Reach, Kelly, you get up here too. Come on, boys. Because they're getting ready to tow some cars, and I want to see if we can stop that. Come on up here. This is our glorious brother. Hi, Clyde. Yes. These guys. Come on, anybody who's a police officer. I want the police officers to come here and get their picture with Nick Nolte because it's more important to me.
If you guys will do
then
that.
After we're done with the police officers,
if you don't mind,
before we get started here, I would want all the lawyers because together we are going to put a class action suit. We are going to get even with everybody. So
you're going to get in this picture, Jimmy? Yeah, you're going to
wait till they're done because I want these for reasons. Hey, I was a policeman. I should get up there. These are all my friends right here. Where's Billy?
If anybody's wondering who this beautiful lady is here, this is Kelly. Kelly's with the FBI. She helps us with our mentoring program. She does a lot of work with us, and you do great work, and we thank you. We thank you for everything that you do.
Right here, Reach Kelly. We were called Deep Cover. We didn't know what the hell we were doing, but we were out there buying drugs, weren't we?
Yeah.
Boy, what a great, and what they did to us. Now picture this, we're 23 years old with no identification, only a gun on our hip, and they're giving us money to drink. I said, wow, this is the great, I never went. And plus I got to buy prostitutes. Oh, and yes, he remembers. I did. I didn't eat it. I did. I loved it all. That was a good job. If you ever get a job like that, take it. Okay. All right, now. All right, police, go back here. Now the lawyers and the judges, please come up here. All lawyers. This is Paul Boas. You stay up here. They're going to torture you with you. This is Paul Boas, John Myers,
judges.
Ricky Weeben,
judges.
This is Judge Lisa, and with that FBI girl again. Hey, the FBI, Kelly, no collusion. There's no collusion.
I'm not standard defense.
All right. Let's get to rocking and rolling. All right.
And if anybody wants to know who this other lovely lady is, Judge Lisa. Judge Lisa works with us. She's also a boxer. We've trained her in the boxing world, and she comes in and she works out at Third Avenue Gym along with Joey, and Joey's right there from Third Ave. And she does a wonderful job also with the mentoring program. And John, both of them. So very good. Thank you, Lisa.
Before we get started, we have one last thing we must do here. My sister, come up here. Chris, come here. Marianne, come on over here. Clyde. This is my sister, Marianne, and this is my brother-in-law, Clyde. And this is Gloria, my wife.
Which he just got married last year. So Jimmy finally.
All right, we get started now. All right, we'll do some poetry. I only got about 500 poems for you tonight. Whoa. we start the poetry. This is my publisher, John. Hello, John. John Zoller. Hey, Victor, you ain't go yet? Okay. Hey, before we go any further, this is Victor Olive from Watson Chevrolet. He helped me get 17,000 Christmas presents last year. All right, let's start the poetry. Come on. Everything I have written in my life is true, except for the parts that I made up. All right, are we trying? Oh, him, yes, my police reports. Where you going, Paul Boas? Hey, I made him a lot of money. I made Paul Boas a lot of money. And he never told all my secrets either. That was great. Thank you, Paul. You know what? I always like to read this one poem about my mother. Because my mother was a beautiful woman. And she raised 7 kids, okay? Now, no matter how you count that, for about 5 years, she was pregnant. You know, every time you turn around, she had a baby there. She was carrying around a loaf of bread. And when my father was a steel worker, and my mother dealt out discipline with a belt. She had beat my ass regularly. And there is nothing nicer in this world when you can outrun your mother. And I would taunt her. I would do it on purpose. I just thought it was wonderful. And then what is also nice, as I got older, my mother would beat my ass, but she wore the belt out, and it didn't hurt anymore. So she'd be going crazy, and of course, she might as well beat a wall. It didn't make a difference. Anyway, but she taught me a valuable lesson. It's called the ass whoop lesson. I use this as a policeman. My mother chased me around the dining room table with a worn leather strap. She wanted to beat my ass raw, and she couldn't catch me because I was quick. She'd run to the left, and I'd run to the right, and run under the table and jump over chairs, and she'd swing the belt at me and miss, and I'd laugh and mock, "Miss me!" And she'd swing again, catching me on the ass, and I'd hoot and holler, and I'd yell, "You hurt my ass!" And she'd yell, "When I get my hands on you, I'm going to beat the devil out of you." I'd taunt, "Can't catch Lucifer because he's too fast." And then I'd juke and fly under the table, and she'd try to block my path with chairs. And I flew up, jack in the box, sticking my fingers in my ears, na 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 na. And she ran and stood on the dining room table. I ran and stood on the dining room table, shaking my ass. She'd swing and I'd jump. The more she swung, the more she missed, and the madder she got. Her face was red like a furnace. Then she stood in a doorway, spun around 3 times, and fell on the ground and kicked her legs straight up in the air. I bust out laughing, and she just lay there, breathing really hard, holding her chest. I said, "Okay, Mom, you can get up." She just lay there, breathing real hard, and I said, "Okay, Mom, you can get up." She just lay there. I jumped over the chair and said, "Okay, Mom, you can get up." She just laid there breathing hard. "Mom," she lay there not moving. I got scared, really scared. I knew I killed my mom. "Mom," I walked over and touched her shoulder. "Mom, come on, Mom." Then, just like a horror movie, she jumped up, grabbed my skinny arm. "I got you now, you little bastard." And she just started to bog my skinny ass. My legs were kicking just like Walter Payton's. I was trying to get away, and she was wailing, cracking the strap off my ass. I broke free. My head went right into the wall, leaving a big dent in the plaster. She whipping and I rubbing my head and my stung ass at the same time. She finished the whipping the tar out of me, and I hobbled to my room. "That wasn't fair. That was a dirty trick playing dead," she said. "Life isn't fair, and wait till your dad sees the hole in the wall." I honestly believe that this little life lesson taught me as a boy helped me later as a man and kept me alive on the streets. And for that alone, I loved her. I'm going to tell you why. I don't know if I could tell you this. Never mind. Hell with it. We'll cut this back and we'll have some fun. I gave most of my morals away and sold the rest in a whorehouse for a moment of pleasure. That's the title. I had a sack full of morals, and I gave them away to people that needed them. And the few that remained, I traded away at a whorehouse. You know, a moment of pleasure, a lifetime of regret. Anyway, God, it's like biting an apple. You broke a tooth, and a broken tooth is hard to hide. Yeah, just like breaking a tooth while biting an apple. Inside my head, that song keeps playing inside my head. That song over and over, playing and playing inside my head. Imagine there's no heaven, no hell below us, above us only sky. You know, God, it's just not fair. And I live long enough to realize that nothing is really fair. The game is fixed. All of the isms, Taoism, Buddhism, Chilladism, know your place-ism, not your turn-ism, stay in your own-ism, hands and feet to yourself-ism, why you hating-ism, brown people don't have a chance-ism, and John Lennon had it all wrong-ism. All we kept saying was, give peace a chance. And if we listen closely from the White House, give war a chance. And tonight, God, I am alone, except with you, and never quite alone. And I want so much more. And I keep thinking of all of the children taken away by those that have much of everything, but everything is never too much. It's just the way of the haves and the have not. And what do we really want to have? I can't imagine heaven without you, God. And sometimes I keep thinking that you will go away again and leave us all alone with ourselves. And you will be gone for eternity. And eternity is forever and ever, especially when you're waiting for a kiss, God. And please try to remember, God, that I gave you most of my morals away to all them that needed them. Ah, for the moment of pleasure, I sold the rest. And I bet that there are people hoping and praying that you, God, are not a little brown person crying for her mama. And that would be just like breaking a tooth while eating an apple. And please, God, promise not to leave us ever again, because it would be hard to imagine. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and join the world will be one. That was the second part. In life, either a man or a woman could do this. Oh, this is my friend Charlie. Say hello to Nick and Charlie. This is Charlie. This is called, if you want, you can try this. If you have someone that makes you mad and really he's kind of a shit ass, don't tell him you made love to his wife. And if you're a woman, don't tell the other woman that you made love to their husband. Tell the man that you made love to his girlfriend. That is the beauty of it all. Now I will prove it to you. I had this sergeant was a ball buster, you know. Need not to mention the sergeant's name. It's really not really that important, because he's the kind of guy that would file some kind of civil suit for slander. We're both retired now, and we're both long of tooth, short of forgiveness. I worked for him for years and watched him as he cut throats, stabbed backs, and fucked asses. He tried to fuck me. Somewhat succeeded, but I never showed him my sore ass. I watched him fuck so many men for no reason than to look good and puff his little bullfrog chest. I watched as he brought men to their knees and he would kick their pride down a sewer. We sometimes meet each other by accident. Pretend that we like each other. I didn't like him for his weak, demeaning, arrogant, overbearing, huffy, son of a bitch of a boss, bastard, prick ways. Yet, I don't blame him. I blame his mother for fucking his daddy. Years ago, an attendant... I'll finish this line. For fucking his daddy years ago instead of blowing him. In life, some men should have been blowjobs for no more than a toss off on dirty sheets. I waited for many years. Revenge, sweet revenge. I knew that we were young. He loved this little hot, slick, black velvet honey. She was part gypsy, and I believe part Irish. Sunshine and freckles. Blue-green eyes, cute ass. Champagne glass, perfect tits. And she was stupid and cute. We called her Peaches. He was married at the time, but most of the cops have a place to rest their lonely hearts. He would sneak around, meet her at different tender traps. He was like a lovesick dog in heat, sniffing and lying, and even carried a picture of her for years in his locker or in his desk drawer. He had a stack of letters written, and I snuck and read them. I laughed my ass off at the weak poems. Heart of fire and soul of desire, and he'd live in a tire if he had the power. Dove and love, honey and bunny, and fight a duel to touch her soul, and on and on. And I stuck my finger down my throat and gagged. Waiting for years, I planned to shake his soul and squeeze his pride to tears. I ran into him at a grocery store. He was with his wife. I told him that I had to talk to him. His wife excused herself and went shopping for grocery. "Sarge, I have a confession to make." He said, "Got to set my soul free." He bit like a catfish in spring. "What's bothering you?" "I want you to be mad at me, but I've been bothered me for years." "What's been bothering you?" I said, "Promise you won't get mad and hate me." He said, "I won't get mad. What's up?" I said, "When you were baiting teachers, I'd wait till you went home to your wife and I'd go over and fuck her." He lost all the cover of his face and turned red. I couldn't help it. Her cute freckles and tight ass, the long silk black velvet hair, big cherry nipples. I lift her soft black velvet pelt, even stuck my pinky up her buckeye. He stuttered and stammered, I don't care. I don't know if you loved her, but you know a stiff prick has a mind of its own. He was visibly shaking his hands and legs, and I said, "Best honey hole I ever rode." She would go down on me like she was playing jazz on Bourbon Street. One time on a midnight ship, she came to the squad room, and don't get mad, I plowed her right on your desk. In fact, the next day, I bought you coffee, and her cute little ass was still pressed against the green dark blotter. She wanted it that way, and we've both been drinking pretty heavy. Clear tears clotted his eyes and words caught in his throat. On my desk, on my desk blotter. I'm sorry, but it was the booze and the poison perfume. And I even went down on her, and she dug her nails in the back of my head. I can still feel her humping my face. He said, "You motherfucker." I said, "Hey, easy, it's been years, and I told you I was sorry. I got to go." but I'm glad I got that off my chest. I walked to the car, and his wife came out of the groceries carrying groceries. I waved at him as I drove past, a shit smile. Now my confession to you. I never fucked this girl. But sometimes you got to hit someone with a left hook. Hit them hard, right in their black, filthy, dirty little heart. Just knock the pride right out of their stinky ass. Ta-da! I have, most of you people know, but I have cancer, okay? And it is something to deal with, you know? Uh-oh. And, well, what happened is, my heart doctor was supposed to be here, but anyway, what happened was, where's Dr. Appleman? Where he at? Oh, here's my cancer doctor! Yeah, my friend. This is my buddy. He gives me all this shit. He gives everybody else really cool shit. He gives me terrible shit. He gives me shit where everybody gets high. You gotta get marijuana. They get all cool shit. What I got was turn me into flubberdub. I said, thank you, doctor. Yeah. Hey, I really like this guy. I got a poem especially for you and the gang. Hey, he really saved my life. I was supposed to kick the bucket a while ago, but he gives me all kind of medicine, and we shits and giggles all the time, laugh. Okay. All right, don't run out the door, because this is you. What happened is I have brain cancer, and I'm going to tell you something for real. I can't remember shit, okay? And people will talk to me. They'll say, hey, Jimmy. Well, I can't remember sometimes. And it just happens, you know, because, okay. Now, while I have this memory, but I want to tell you the secret, there's some people I don't want to talk to anyway. So it's a trade-off. I thought, what a wonderful thing to happen. Now, this happened for real. I was in the hospital. They went inside my brain. Now you're wide awake. They're cutting in your head, okay? And they're talking to you. You can hear the song for 9 hours. And I'm sitting here, and these Dr. Acklimar not coming, did he? He's gonna try to make it. Well, right, well, they can make you say anything on that table, and I know this ahead of time. Ha! So I trick them. I have these two African American fighters. I brought them up there. My doctor was African American. So I brought my two fighters up. They met Dr. Acklimar. He was from Philadelphia, I believe. So he come here. I said, Dr. Acklimar, these are my fighters. This is a professional, Monte. I brought the other Golden Glove champion. I said, doctor, you're going to operate on me within the next half hour, 45 minutes. These are my two boxers. If you make a mistake, they will know exactly what to do to you. And meantime, this guy thought I was goofy. And then I called people up. Hello, hello, hello. I don't remember talking to you. I think you came to see me. Hello, hello, hello. I don't remember nothing. But what a great position to be in. I was in perfect denial. And then I'm hoping to God, while they're operating on me, doing this, I mean, you're naked. You have nothing. They have bolts in my head. They're taking my head apart. Good. So I'm sitting there now. I'm praying to God. I said, doc, don't ask me stupid thing about my penis. Don't ask me, because I will be embarrassed. I said, please don't take me down that road. And he promised me, crossed his heart and hoped to die. And I asked him later. He said, I didn't. And I was hoping. I wanted, you know. Anyway, this is what happened. This did happen to me. You never knew this, but I'll tell you now. I turned into the Sequoia, where things happened to me, and I have no control. I was in the hospital for a brain bleed, a couple of golf ball tumors in my dome. The doctor prescribed to me a small little pill that would help me with my headache. He gave me a steroid of some sort, but I think he gave me the wrong pill. Mind you, it was a small little blue pill, and I'd never been afraid of pills. I took the pill, and something wonderful happened. I think, but I'm not really sure for sure. I fell back to sleep, and I woke at 4:30 in the morning. I had this huge boner, and I said, "What is that?" I was afraid at first, and I thought it was purely magical. I've been always proud of my little soldier, and although it has never been somewhat, although I've been somewhat proud, my little Johnson was never a showpiece. This was strange, and at the same time, magnificent. It was like a sequoia sticking out all straight and purple pride. I could have hung a flag on my pole. It was the size of a huge, giant redwood. It was so hard that a blue veiner that a cat couldn't scratch. But the gods have a way, ha ha, to punish you. There was no one there to share the wonderment. All I could do was worship it, the huge beauty. I thought of naming it, but the only name I could think of was Blue. Yes, I would name my stiffy Blue. The doctor came and apologized and said, "I'm sorry, they gave you the wrong pill." "That's all wrong, all right, Doc. It was quite interesting to turn into a sequoia. And to tell you the truth, I have never been a tree before. That was kind of fun." I later told my lawyer, and he told me, I told him what had happened. He told me that I could have a malpractice and sue the doctor. "Are you crazy?" I said. "I could never sue that good man. Actually, I want to give the doctor a raise." You see, that little pill went to the wrong head. And in his defense, my little head has been doing most of my thinking all of my life. And maybe it should have been turned into a tree. That was for you. Santa, where you at? Come on up, Santa Claus. This is my Santa Claus. For 49 years, we've been delivering Christmas presents, but Santa Claus has been doing it forever. Santa Claus, I met him. He is one of Dr. Appelman's patients, too. Santa Claus was in Vietnam, like I was. And Agent Orange has affected him also. He has some issues that are kind of trying us. It tries our strength. Santa Claus and me, we went around to the schools. We gave out hundreds and hundreds of Christmas presents together. It was really cool, wasn't it, Santa? You want to do it again?
Anytime you want.
All right, Santa, we'll have some fun. Thank you. When I was in Vietnam, I write some poems about it, you know. And I want you to know something. I'm not kidding when I tell you this. I'm against all wars. I was no hero. I saw war. I saw men at their worst, and I've seen it affect so many men. And anybody that's really been to war, and man or woman, if they see war, it will disturb them, and they will have some memories that will stay with them forever. All wars are wrong. There is no right, and many innocent people die. And I will read to this. This is called a square peg in a round hole, or a letter to God. I also believe in God very much. I don't play around with this. I believe strongly in God. I get up at 3:00 in the morning. I've written, I don't know, a couple hundred poems. I talk with God. I really do. Now, you don't have to believe me, but we have this energy that is really good for me. So what happens is, I don't care what anybody believes in. I don't care if you're Buddha, Muhammad, Allah. I don't care. I just know there's something great out there, and it will be fun someday, I believe. Oh, the other thing, you know, everybody runs around and wants to have their ass tickled with a feather. Oh, sure. Nice job. You did good. You did good. It is all feel-good stuff. But I will let you in on a secret. Someday, sometime, you will have to explain things at a higher level. You will not be judged for the thing that you've done. You will be judged by the things that you have not done and could have. God knows what you did. It's the things that you didn't do to make the world a better place. That is how you will be judged. Now, square peg in a round hole, or a letter to God. Pounding a square peg in a round hole, smashing the peg, smashing, pounding the peg, pounding till it almost fits, or writing a love letter in the sand like an old Pat Boone song. That's exactly like trying to force a poem, like sitting on the pot unable to shit. It's the same thing, and Buck was right. Don't try. Going back to 1969, Benoit sitting at a card table with a soldier from the first cav, and he told me, we captured a gook, and he didn't want to talk. So we tied him in front of the APC and broke brush with him until he was dead. Broke every bone in his body. And then it didn't matter if he talked. We were just getting even when they buried our soldiers up to their neck and left the two-step killers bite their necks. They put the snake in a cage and released, taunting the snake, taunting and taunting, till the snake bit and killed our guys. I listened to the war stories over beer, and then it hit me in the chest like a bullet fired from a sniper. I knew war was wrong. I hated the sound of madness, what the fires of hell turned us into, and there was nothing that I could do. We were no longer men. All wars are wrong. Men no longer can see, nor hear, nor feel. They can only taste the blood of anger. I folded my cards and left the table. I walked away sick and looked into the vast sky of war, wanting only God. I wish that I could put God into the chest of mankind like a sniper's bullet. I wish that I could make them kneel in thanks for the gift of life. I picked up the hammer and pounded a square peg and wrote a love letter in the sand to God. Okay. Now, I know Nick was here a minute ago. What happened to Nick? Go get him. We are going to read something together. And then Nick will answer a whole bunch of questions. He knows all the dirt in Hollywood. And I think it's fun because he will tell, maybe. I will read you this poem, then me and Nick will close it up. You leaving? Goodbye. This is Ronnie. Helps me with Christmas, too, and that's his wife, Shelley. Thank you. Bye, Joey.
He's coming in right now.
Nick, you come here now. I wrote a book called Log Dog is a Love from Hell. Okay, that's not necessary. What happens is, I want you to know something. My colors are, yeah. Yeah, we'll get, My colors are black and white and red. Black is for the darkness I don't know about. Red is from the blood of the broken hearts. And white is the purity of my soul. I will always carry myself in life like that. But me and Nick will do a poem together. All right, you ready, Nick?
I don't know.
Oh, we'll find out.
Okay, we'll find out.
All right.
You, sir.
Now, listen, I know how to drive. Look, and I drove my mother crazy. I know how to drive women crazy. I really do. And it doesn't take much, honest to God. Drives them crazy.
What?
Me and the trooper were having dinner. He ordered a grease barter. I ordered broccoli. I said, you know what really drives women crazy?
What?
Huh?
What?
Eh?
What?
Eh?
What?
Eh?
Pass this here. So.
It's not your fault.
Huh?
Eh?
What?
Huh?
Yeah.
Eh?
Thanks, hey, the girl's kissing and you get a hairpiece.
You need a new hairpiece.
Huh?
Eh?
Sometimes I gotta take crap and only can fart.
Something wrong with your heart. Mine too, I have to take pills.
We all gotta take pills.
You gotta pay pills, what?
Well, my old man went deaf when he was 40.
No, I don't know what the hell happened to Shorty. I think he died. Somebody said he was hit by a train.
When I get up in the morning, I got pain in my head, my back, my ass hurts. I said, head.
Head. I'm lucky if you only lets me touch it.
What?
You know what? You think it's going to rain.
Huh?
I got to wait till she falls asleep, and I try to sneak her.
What happened to Shorty?
Huh?
He got herpes?
He lost his hair and got a cheap hairpiece.
Who?
Oh, no kidding. Shorty got herpes. What a damn shame.
Real shame.
Guess he was kissing the wrong dame.
Probably.
Eh?
What?
Shorty's going bald.
Shorty's got balls.
He got tall.
Oh, he's got no hair.
He'll never get any head.
You're right. He only has himself to blame.
What's he doing? What's the old lady's doing?
Once in a while, it
goes boing, boing.
Boing.
It drives women crazy.
What?
Eh?
Oh, yeah. You boys want some more coffee?
We both said, eh? She poured us some more coffee. She could be my granddaughter. I'll leave the tip.
Nice tits.
All right, I'll leave the tip. Drives them insane.
You're right. We better hurry back. It's going to rain.
Okay. Listen, I'm going to wind this thing with Nick now. Nick is going to give you a little history of all the women that he sat there and dinged in Hollywood. And he's going to... All right, you sit here. Tell them a little bit about what you did. Movies. Tell them a different movie. Nick has met Marlon Brando. Tell them about it here. I can't talk for you. You're up. Go ahead.
You got to take a rest.
I know.
You
go ahead.
Sit down.
Go ahead. Up.
Take a rest. Take that little blue pill. You won't be able to get out the door. I didn't want to write a biography, but I did write a biography. And it took a lot of people were saying, you ought to tell these stories about Catherine Hepburn, and you ought to tell the stories about Mitchum, and you ought to tell these stories. So I sat down with a few writers and tried to tell them. But these stories are funny in the context of living life, you know. They're sardonic, they're funny, and they're humorous. Like, Catherine Hepburn threw a script over my fence, and it was called The Ultimate Solution of Grace Quigley. And I thought, well, this is a great piece of Catherine Hepburn. My God, she throws it over. She doesn't go through agents. So Hal Ashby was going to produce it. And I thought, wow, Hal Ashby's going to direct it. My God, that's going to be something. So I got these directions to go down to Hal's house on the beach, meet with Catherine, and we'd set up the film. So I'm down there, and everything is great, and Catherine is great. And Hal says, well, I'm not going to direct the film because I made films like this. You remember when Donald Pleasance was the president and he was the gardener? We should elect that guy because we have a different kind of gardener in the White House today. You know, but and when I found that out, being a young actor, I said, "You're not going to direct it?" I said, "Who's going to direct it?" And he said, "Well, the writer will direct it." And I just, for some reason, I just wouldn't go that way. So I said, "Well, I got to think about this." And I thought about it and so it was off. So I thought about it for 5 years. And I realized, geez, Catherine Hepburn, and this is a great story about old people and their need and wish to go ahead and leave life in a graceful way. And it was a great tale about her seeing a guy, a kid back from Vietnam, and she sees him do a hit. And she blackmails him into offing her. And he doesn't want to do that, but, you know, she's got the goods on him. And so he reluctantly says okay, and she tells all her old friends that she's leaving for the next world. And they all say, "How did you arrange that?" And she said, "Well, I have this friend that will help us." And so they ask her if he would help them. And now she approaches with me to off all her old friends in a gentle way. It's a very complicated film, you know. And it may not be funny, and, you know, it's a real risky one. Only Catherine Hepburn would suggest to do this at 75. She said to me one day, she said, "You know, Nick, I don't have Parkinson's disease. My father shook, my grandfather shook, and I shake." Well, she did have Parkinson's, but it took another 10 years before she shook too much. And I said, "Well, Catherine, you're the best actress I know that can keep your head still by holding on with your hands. Because most actors get their hands like this, and then they don't know what to do, but they're keeping their head still." And she had learned all these devices. Her special trick was she would take you into her apartment in New York, which was down a few stairs. It was on, like, I don't know what street, but anyway, she'd take you down into the living room, and she would say, "Pick a chair." Well, there was a comfortable chair there, and there was a nice one here. Then there was a couch over there and another chair. And it all depended on what chair you picked. And so I picked the one by the fireplace, and she said, "Ah, you picked Spencer's chair." And I said, "Well, yeah." And she said, "The only difference between you, Nick, and Spencer is that Spencer only drank when he wasn't working. You drink all the time." And I said, "Well, not all the time, Catherine." She said, "Well, you've been in every gutter of New York." And I said, "No, there's a few I haven't made yet. You know, we'll see if we get through this." And it was all right. Everything worked out well. But the night before we were rehearsing the drowning scene where the young man and Catherine drown, we had to rehearse that. And I was walking down the street with my friend Billy Cross and my makeup man, and a plainclothes car pulls over. And a guy gets out, and he comes back to us, and he said, "We're FBI, and we are going around looking at illegally gambling here in New York City. Do you want to ride with us?" And I looked at Eddie, and I looked at Billy, and I said, "Yeah, I would like to ride, but look, I got to be at this harbor at 9 o'clock in the morning for this test. If you can get me there, I'll go ahead and ride." We got in the car with them. So we had the two FBI guys in the front and three of us in the back. And in those days, we had a little bit of maybe wrong stuff. And I thought, "Oh, Jesus, this is either their easiest bust that they've ever had." get in the back seat with these FBI guys. Are they really going to do this? And they really did it. They would go up these brownstone, and we'd go up there, and they'd break in, and there would be these guys gambling, and it would get real still and real scary, and real guns were around, and we would just stand off to the side, and then they'd leave. They wouldn't hassle them, and they'd just get out of there. But they didn't get me there at 9 o'clock. They got me there at 9:30. So Catherine is mad at me, and she goes right at me. Are you going to be this way, out drinking all night and all this stuff? And I said, I wasn't drinking all night. I was with these guys, and I can't explain it. She said, oh, just get ready. We'll do the test. And so we did the test, and we're in the water. And she's got a bathing suit on that was an old-fashioned bathing suit, and the air would get underneath the suit. And so when we would sink below the water, she would float up to the top again because of the air bubble in her suit. So I'd grab a hold of her foot and pull her back down to the water. And she got so mad. She said, I know how to swim. Don't do grab my foot like that. And I said, but your swimming suit is floating you to the top. She said, well, let me float then. You know, she was mad at me. So after that day, she said to me, listen, Nick, if you need to get some sleep, I know a doctor that can get you some Thorazine. Well, if you know what Thorazine is, you don't ever want to take it. You won't ever move again, you know, for the next 8 hours. You will just be frozen in one spot. I said, no, Catherine, no, thank you. I'll get some sleep, and I won't be late again. And then in about 10 minutes, her three hairdressers came out. And they said, Catherine didn't tell us to do this, but we have something for you you might need. And they held out 5 Quaaludes each. And I said, yes, I could use those. And I took all. You weren't around, so you couldn't have busted me. So I know she sent them out there with those. And she was a treat to work with. We made the film, and it was a good film. Rex Reed called it a Nazi film because of The Ultimate Solution of Grace Quagley. And it was great fun. But those are the kind of stories that are in the book that's written. That's just one of them. And, yeah. Jimmy wanted me to bring it up.
There is something I want Nick to tell you about when he was going to be a ball player, what he did to the bunk bed. Go ahead, Nick.
Well, this is a Savetti's kind of story. You know, there are some great football teams in America, and Oklahoma's probably one of the great college teams, you know, there year after year. There was a Bud Wilkinson football camp up in Minnesota. So when I was young, I used to go to the Bud Wilkinson football camp. And it was mainly for Oklahoma players, but they would take two people from each state. So it'd be 2 kids from Iowa, 2 kids from Nebraska, and so on. And they would make up, and they'd bring in 20 Oklahoma players. And it's all Oklahoma coaches. So I meet this guy named Charlie Freeman from Omaha, and I'm from Waterloo, Iowa. It's our second year, and for some reason we got up there a day early. You know, they weren't arriving for... We were there on Friday, and they were coming in on Monday. And we didn't have anything to do. And the girls' camp wasn't in. The girls weren't there. Nothing was there. So, and it was tough because they would pit us against these coached Oklahoma kids, you know. And they were definitely prejudiced to the Oklahoma kids. So Chuck and I were trying to think of a prank that we could pull, and we decided that maybe we could shit in a bag. But we would have to disguise it so well that they wouldn't be able to find it. So we did, and we smashed it down to about an eighth of an inch thick, and now it was about 2-3 feet wide and around. And then underneath the, we lived in chalets, and the Oklahoma kids are all in the one chalet. And so we put it underneath the lower bunk bed, which had a canvas bottom, springs, and then a canvas bottom, then the mattress, and then the sheet. So we put it above the canvas so you couldn't see it. And I forgot about it, and a week into this practice, a kid said to me from Oklahoma, "We got a horrible smell in our chalet, and we can't figure out what it is. And we're gonna pull all our beds out. We're gonna take everything out of the chalet, and we're gonna find out what it is. I mean, it's a dead animal or something." And they pulled it out, and they found this thin sheet of shit, you know. Now, Charlie Freeman was probably the most creative kid I ever ran into. He had a light mind, kind of like this guy, very creative. But he came from a wealthy family, and it was kind of rough. But Chuck knew how to look at those Oklahoma guys and say, "No, I wouldn't do anything like that." And I said, "No, I wouldn't do anything like that." But that coach came in that night at 8 o'clock, lights out, and the door opens, and a flashlight comes in, and he comes right to my bunk, and he shines the light on me. He says, "Nolte, I'm going to make sure you never play football in America again." And all the teams I got kicked off of from then on, I think that letter preceded me. And that's how I became an actor, really. It was a good thing.
Well, you know what? I know many of the things because we spend time together, and it's been really wonderful. I can't thank this guy enough. He's a people person. He cares about people. So I want you to give a great ovation for Nick. We have some of my books for sale out here. And we have a bottle of wine. Dwayne is selling it. All the money we make on the wine and the books, I give everything to children. I've never put anything in my pocket. I always give it away. But I'm very fortunate. What's funny, I would tell people I knew Nick Nolte. He's a friend of mine. And they would look at me and say, "Jimmy has an imaginary friend." But ladies and gentlemen, we've used a lot of your time tonight. You can take pictures with Nick, drink the wine, and anything we could do with you or for you. Oh, we're going to have a Halloween party down here. Oh, Dwayne, come up here. Come on up here. This is the guy that gave us the wine, and he helped us out. Dwayne there. We are going to raffle these wine bottles if they want to buy them. How much are they?
100 each if he signs them.
He will sign them for $100. You'll have a collector's item. And the money will go to children. If you don't buy them or buy a ticket on them, I will drink them later when I'm alone. All right, so listen, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, Frankie and Mouse. There are two boys that I grew up with right there. Brian, come up here. Brian, when he was a little boy, me and Brian was arrested because we had a quart of Tiger Rose wine on us. And they took us.
We never drank.
The cops grabbed us. They threw us and took us home by the seat of our ass. And then my mother sat there and says, "I just gave him $2 to go to the dance." She held up the bottle of wine like this and sucker punched me right out of my shoes. He had his father was Big Jim, beat his ass. And we weren't allowed to loaf together anymore, ever, ever. But we fold them.
Yeah, about 2 weeks, three weeks.
3 weeks later. Punished the shit out of us, didn't they? Oh, boy. Anyway, this is my good, and that's Frankie over there. That's a good guy. Thanks for coming, guys. Hey, look, and I like, this is Jimmy Mitchell. Mitchell's Bar. Everybody goes down there. This is Kelly from the mall. Kelly from the mall helps us with the house and the thing. Kelly, and this is Char. Okay. And that's Joe, and Joan Byer helps me with the poetry. Listen, thank you very much. Enjoy your evening now. If you want to buy these wine bottles, come up and buy them. All right, good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.